Our second case this morning is United States against Hunter. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Robert Perrone, and I represent the appellant in this case, MK3 Jesse Hunter. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes at the end for rebuttal.
You may do so.
RCM 705C2D and RCM 1109 do not permit pretrial misconduct to form the basis of a withdrawal from the sentencing limitation portion of the pretrial agreement. RCM 705C2D and RCM 1109 are strict temporal rules that operate within a timeline. These two rules working together allow the convening authority to set forth the conditions of the defendant's post-trial probation in the PTA. They also allow the convening authority to withdraw from the pretrial agreement and vacate a suspended sentence if there is further misconduct only after a judge has found the defendant guilty and sentenced him. These two rules do not apply to or address a period prior to a guilty finding or a sentence. RCM 705C2D
and Counsel 1109 clearly doesn't, because by terms it applies to vacation suspended sentences. But how do you say that 705 doesn't? Conditions of probation before action by the convening authority as well as during any period of suspension, which is the part that's relevant to 1109.
Yes, Your Honor. 705, and I was just about to get this, 705 anticipates two time periods. One from the time period begins after a judge sentences the defendant and ends at the time the convening authority takes action. And then the second period of time under 705 is a period of time after the convening authority takes action and ends after the suspension of the sentence terminates. So prior to that period, prior to the convening authority's action...
What in 705D, C2D, makes you say it doesn't apply to pre-sentencing conduct?
Because, sir, because, Your Honor, pre-sentencing conduct, there is no sentence. There is no sentence that can be suspended applying 1109.
Well, a promise to conform the accused conduct to certain condition before action as well as during any period of suspension.
Yes, Your Honor. Before action would also imply that there is a sentence that's been adjudicated.
Does it?
If it, in, when we look at the yes, Your Honor, because at a time period at a court martial, up until the time that the judge, the military judge, says, I find you guilty, and then after that, when he judges a sentence, up until the time that he finds him guilty, there still is a presumption of innocence for the defendant, and there is no sentence that can be suspended.
Do you argue that in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor. RCM 7, those are the two time periods under RCM 705C2D. Under RCM 1109, the vacation of a suspension of a sentence can only be based on a violation of the conditions of suspension which occur within the period of suspension.
Counsel, what is there a case that stands for the proposition that the rule you have cited on permissible terms or conditions is an exclusive rule as to the conditions that can be freely entered into between the accused and the convening authority?
No, Your Honor, there is no case for that. And
so
RCM does allow that convening authorities and appellants or defendants are allowed to enter in enter into any agreement. The problem is any agreement that they enter into has to be subject to judicial scrutiny. And here, when we look at it in terms of the second argument and this...
I understand your second argument. I'm talking about the first argument. If, let's presume there was adequate judicial scrutiny in this case, and no point that you're not conceding, but if there had been, why would this be a problem to enter into an agreement saying you're going to behave yourself during the period between the time you enter into this agreement and the time the convening authority takes action?
Well, Your Honor, we have to further break that time period out. Between the time period that you enter into the agreement and when the convening authority takes action, if we look at 705C2D and 1109, they are probationary rules. And probation, by its very nature, requires that by its nature and by its definition, require that there actually be a sentence in place. You can't put someone on probation under the military justice, under RCM, you can do other things, put them in restraint, et cetera, in the military justice system, but you can't put them on a probation unless they've actually been sentenced. The probation is a type of sentence. So prior to the imposition of a
sentence. Why isn't this simply a convening authority and accused entering into agreement that says the agreement won't take effect if a certain circumstance comes to pass? And in this case, the circumstance would, for example, you have agreements if you don't, you get a pretrial agreement if you agree to testify in another case. If the individual doesn't testify, then the convening authority is not bound by the pretrial agreement and the full sentence can take place. Why isn't this the same thing? When that circumstance transpires, that is, the individual engages in misconduct after the convening authority has agreed to the PTA, then the PTA is no longer in force.
Well, Your Honor, that's also, specifically in this case, that's a question in this case. We don't know exactly when the misconduct occurred.
I don't see that anywhere in your brief that you've argued in this case that the misconduct didn't occur after the convening authority entered into the agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see anywhere in your brief where you argue this, you know, sort of semi-constitutional question about probation. I see a temporal argument having to do with the basically a statutory construction argument about Rule 705 and the applicability of 1109 and a supposed lack of juncture. But I don't see anywhere in here where you argue that the proposition you advanced to me a few minutes ago.
I believe that argument, Your Honor, was in the reply brief filed on September 24th. There's one of the arguments in there that,
okay.
And I cited the Black's Law Dictionary in there actually as to the definitions of what probation are and what a suspended sentence are. Both of them do, in fact, say that a sentence needs to be adjudicated before those can actually take effect.
Just to go back to the issue as granted, though, that issue, as I see it and as it was put in your supplement and briefed, does not challenge the question of whether the misconduct here took place after the agreement was entered into. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Thank you.
Nevertheless, we have to consider what is at stake here. We're looking at what the government has termed as a post-trial agreement, and the appellant submits that this is not a post-trial agreement. This is, in fact, and every indication by the convening authority and everything that was ever submitted in this case says that the convening authority is withdrawing from the sentencing portion of the pretrial agreement or vacating a part of the suspended sentence. The government's trying to pose this as a post-trial agreement under Dawson and Pilkington. And those two are not applicable in this case. This is not a post-trial agreement, much like a Pilkington-Dawson post-trial agreement. This is a withdrawal from the by the convening authority of a suspension of part of the sentence.
In terms of the posture of the case, is the government, is your view that the government's arguing that this can only be viewed as a post-trial agreement, or is that an alternative argument that they're offering?
The government seems to be arguing that that is the full argument, that there is no alternative argument. And I submit that even if there is, and the panel, of course, does submit that the post-trial, it is not a post-trial agreement, but even if we do consider this a post-trial agreement, we still have to consider that you do have to have 59A prejudicial scrutiny here. And the government, again, argues that if it is a post-trial agreement, you don't need the 59A scrutiny. And you do, because there was error here by the judge on the second issue. The military judge failed to explain a full page in the pretrial agreement about this misconduct provisions, and these misconduct provisions that actually did, were violated. We're not talking about a provision of a PTA where, for instance, we're arguing about witnesses not being called for within a 100-mile radius. We're arguing about something that actually took place and something that actually did happen. And so that is the prejudice under 59A that is required for that analysis.
Well, would there have been prejudice based on that, based on this, the military judge's failure to discuss this provision, but for the fact that the appellant had a subsequently bad urinalysis?
Could you repeat that?
Sure. I mean, you're saying that there's prejudice because, that, you know, that the military judge erred and that there's prejudice because he suffered additional confinement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he suffer additional confinement because the military judge didn't explain the term to him, or did he suffer additional confinement because he committed additional misconduct?
He suffered additional confinement because of something that happened and some sort of understanding between the convening authority and the defense counsel. And I would submit that we do still need to scrutinize this because there is a sort of sub rosa agreement that's going on here. And one thing that's clearly missing from this record is portions of what that agreement are. This is a post-trial agreement, and in a post-trial agreement, it's a post-trial, I'm not conceding that this is a post-trial agreement, but if we were to concede this is a post-trial agreement, or we would find this is a post-trial agreement, this post-trial agreement is modifying a pretrial agreement. And courts closely scrutinize pretrial agreements and need to closely scrutinize pretrial agreements. It's a military judge's duty to scrutinize that and to make sure that the defendant understands what's going on there.
Is this a novation?
Pardon me?
Is this a novation? Well, in contract law, you know, where you basically take an existing contract and you replace it with something by the agreement of the parties, is this so-called this post-trial thing an ovation, or what is it? What's your position? What is this thing?
Without conceding that there is a post-trial agreement, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm asking what you say it is.
This is the convening authority withdrawing from a portion of the sentencing.
Unilaterally?
The unilateral withdrawal would apply to the period before the sentence.
Right. Right. Well, but I'm asking you, are you saying that this is a unilateral, an unlawful unilateral withdrawal, or what?
Is this an unlawful unilateral
withdrawal? Yeah, right, because we're no longer before a sentence.
It's not a unilateral withdrawal, Your Honor. There is some, if it were a unilateral withdrawal, there would have been no discussion between the trial defense counsel.
So there's some sort of thing out there.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's not an agreement.
It's not a post-trial agreement. Under Dawson and Pilkington, it is some sort of, I see you have
comments. Please, I'll conclude with your answer, Judge Stokey.
Some sort of, And I don't want to use meeting of minds because, again, that's a contractual term.
Well, it's a contract.
It is, Your Honor, but it is and it isn't.
We've described PTAs as constitutional contracts.
Yes, Your Honor. And this, like a PTA, is a constitutional contract. It is something where you're giving up rights, fundamental rights that you have, inherent rights that you have, and you are expecting something back. And in this case, again, the major thing that's lacking here, why this can't be a valid post-trial agreement, is there is no judicial scrutiny here. A post-trial agreement should be accorded the same judicial scrutiny as a pretrial agreement, if it's modifying the terms of the pretrial agreement. If we don't do that, then what we're looking at is sort of a way that the convening authority can just modify pretrial agreements without having them subject to judicial scrutiny.
The CC found error on that. The CCA found error, did it not, on your issue, too?
Yes, Your Honor.
It is the issue of prejudice that's at play.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
May it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Patrick Flynn. I represent the United States in this case. Pretrial misconduct can form the basis for withdrawal from the sentence limiting portion of the pretrial agreement. The plain words of 705C2D say that. The appellant urges this court to read the temporal requirements of RCM 1109 into 705C2D, but doing so would make 705C2D meaningless. 1109, by its terms, only applies to vacating a suspended sentence for misconduct that occurs during the period of suspension. 705C2D talks about putting terms in a pretrial agreement whereby the accused agrees to conform his conduct to certain conditions prior to action. Obviously, prior to action, there can be no suspended sentence. If you were to read 1109 into, or the temporal requirements of 1109 into 705C2D, you would have an absurd result. You would have had the president issuing a rule for court-martial, specifically allowing certain terms in a pretrial agreement, but then making those terms by another rule unenforceable. That doesn't make any sense. The only logical way to interpret the requirement for filing the for following 1109 that's written into 705C2D is to interpret that as meaning you have to follow the procedural requirements outlined in 1109, not the temporal requirements.
In that context, is your argument about some kind of new agreement here, is that an alternative argument, or is that your description of what happened?
It's the government's position that that is what happened in this case.
That seems a little odd to me as I read the record. So I read the record, correct me if I'm if I'm wrong, the accused and the government and the convening authority entered into a pretrial agreement regarding subsequent misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor.
The military judge then entered the findings and sentence and erred, as the Court of Criminal Appeals said, in not going over this particular term. We'll get to that as a second issue, but let's assume that's not an issue right now and that you've got a good pretrial agreement. Then misconduct came to the attention of the convening authority, and the appellant's count, as part of that agreement that they had made, there was going to be a hearing. That's the reference to 1109. Appellant's counsel agreed to waive that hearing. That is, the convening authority still hasn't acted to withdraw from the agreement. He has to have a hearing. The defense counsel says, if you don't have, you know, I'll agree to not, to our client not having the hearing if you don't completely withdraw from the agreement and you only withdraw from it partially. That doesn't sound like a new pretrial agreement or a post-trial agreement to substitute for the one that had already been made. It sounds to me like that this is an agreement solely within the context of the hearing that would otherwise be required. So that there's not a substitute pretrial agreement or post-trial agreement here. There's merely an offer to waive the hearing that's required under the pretrial agreement in exchange for not the convening authority not withdrawing completely from it.
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that that's what makes this a post-trial agreement vice a withdrawal under the terms of the PTA, because a withdrawal implies a unilateral action on the part of the convening authority with no negotiation between appellant and the convening
authority. The convening authority had agreed that he couldn't do this unilaterally. The express terms of the pretrial agreement said he had to have a hearing.
I understand what you're saying.
We're not dealing here with a pretrial agreement that says if you commit misconduct, the convening authority can withdraw from the agreement. We don't have that before us. We don't have a unilateral provision before us. The terms that are before us are ones that involve interaction between the appellant and the convening authority before the convening authority can withdraw.
Yes, Your Honor. Clearly, the convening authority would have to go through several procedural hurdles before a withdrawal could take place. When I used the term unilateral, I meant that it was a decision made by the convening authority and without negotiation about the outcome between appellant and the convening authority, as opposed to a negotiated solution, which the government's position is takes this into the realm of a post-trial agreement, a unilateral decision after going through the appropriate procedural steps and having adequate findings on which to base a decision to withdraw. Appellant has no opportunity to participate in the decision that the convening authority makes. The appellant has an opportunity to participate in the 1109 hearing, but doesn't have an opportunity to participate in the convening.
And in the end, the convening authority didn't say, oh, here's a new agreement that I'm entering into with you. I didn't see any new agreement in the record. What I see is the convening authority saying, I hereby partially withdraw from the sensing limitations as opposed in the pretrial agreement. In other words, as I read the record, the convening authority is still operating within the pretrial agreement and is still operating in the mode of a withdrawal. He's not operating as if there's some new agreement here as to what they're going to do with the findings in the sentence.
It's certainly true, Your Honor, that the record does use the term withdrawal and talks about the convening authority deciding to partially withdraw. However, in the staff judge advocate's advice to the convening authority, specifically it refers to the fact that there is a post-trial agreement. And it's obvious that among the participants there was some confusion as to exactly what type of animal this was, but regardless of what they may have called it, it's clear that there was a negotiation between the appellant and the convening authority concerning how to dispose of the new misconduct that had come to the attention of the convening authority after the appellant's trial.
And the new misconduct, it would appear, is only at issue because that's part of the pretrial agreement. That is, there's no substitute for that pretrial agreement here. That pretrial agreement is still in effect. That's what's governing the process.
Well, Your Honor, the government would submit that even if there wasn't a pretrial agreement, once the convening authority learns of new misconduct committed by an appellant, the appellant does have the right to negotiate with the convening authority for a disposition of the new misconduct.
Counsel, I have no further questions because I may be missing something, but I'm not sure how any of this argument helps your case. But that's your privilege.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you turn to prejudice on the issue two, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The Coast Guard Court properly found that it was error for the military judge not to inquire into the terms of the pretrial agreement relating to misconduct. However, appellant has not asserted any prejudice from that failure. Although it's true that the appellant did wind up spending 60 additional days in confinement, that was not as a result of the military judge's failure to explain the misconduct provisions of the pretrial agreement. That was because the appellant engaged in misconduct, and then the appellant's counsel engaged the convening authority in negotiations in order to dispose of the new misconduct.
What about a sort of Damocles-type argument that but for the specter of an 11-9 giving him even more confinement, he negotiated for something less, which is only logical to do?
Well, Your Honor, this Court has said that when looking at post-trial negotiations, the court needs to look at whether the appellant was stripped of substantial rights, coerced into making the agreement, or deprived of due process. And in Pilkington and Dawson, this court did not find that the disparity in the bargaining positions of the convening authority versus the appellant rendered the negotiations so unfair that you could say it was a sword of Damocles hanging over the appellant.
The CCA states, at the time of the providence inquiry by the military judge in this case, the CCA did not find prejudice. At the time of the providence inquiry by the military judge in this case, appellant surely was aware of his conduct that, if discovered, could trigger the misconduct provisions. But apparently he didn't understand the misconduct provisions. You just described them in your previous comments with Judge Efron and said they were confusing and no one really understood whether what was going on with the second round of stuff. But nonetheless, appellant is on his own on this. Isn't that why military judges are supposed to explain these things?
Yes, Your Honor.
If the lawyers don't know what's going on, the judge is supposed to explain it to the appellant.
I believe I misspoke if I indicated the lawyers didn't know what was going on.
Well, you referred to confusion about
the terminology.
Yes, and what the second round of whatever was, whether it was a new agreement, a amendment to the previous agreement, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor. The, I believe that the...
So this guy, the appellant, knows he's done something wrong already. At least that's what the CCA concluded.
Yes.
And there's a provision in his PTA that says, if we find out you've done anything wrong other than what we've charged you with, bad things will happen.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the judge didn't explain what that provision meant. Why is that not prejudicial?
Because the misconduct committed by the accused, the concept that misconduct will cause bad things to happen is not a complicated
concept. Use the technical terminology.
That's right. It's not a complicated concept. As a matter of fact, it would be fair to say that somebody who is facing a court-martial for misconduct already is well aware of the fact that bad things will happen when they commit misconduct.
Subject to truncated procedures and without the government having to prove that misconduct.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
However, that's something he might wanted to have known going into all of this, because he knew he'd already conducted the misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor. However, he received a better benefit based on his post-trial negotiations than, he received a fairly good benefit because he retained all of the protections in his pretrial agreement with the exception of only spending an additional 60 days in confinement.
So there was consideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, in addition, leaving the question of whether he was benefited or not benefited by the 60 days of additional confinement is one of the questions that we should be looking at in terms of prejudice in the context of a guilty plea case, is whether he's ever alleged whether if he had understood the term, he wouldn't have pled guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that is an important point. And it's important to note that...
And has he ever made that allegation?
No, Your Honor, the appellant has never made that allegation. It's important to note, as this court pointed out in Dawson, that had the post-trial negotiations and the decision to impose an additional 60 days confinement been something that appellant thought was unfair or illegal, he could have requested a post-trial 39A session to resolve the issue. But the appellant never asked for a post-trial 39A session. The appellant's 1105 clemency submissions specifically request that the convening authority let him out 150 days, not the original 120 that were part of his pretrial agreement. And even in the course of the appeal, the appellant has never alleged that he didn't understand or that somehow this was unfair.
Counsel, how many days did you have fun? How many months did he wind up serving in confinement? How many months did he wind up serving in confinement, actual time?
Actual time, I don't know the actual number of days, but knowing what the credit for good time is, it would have been...
Without the credit, in other words, what was his sentence? What was his sentence? His sentence was 100 and...
120 plus the additional 60, 180 days.
180 days, that's 6 months. And the maximum of special court martial is 12 months?
Yes, sir.
So if we rule in the appellant's favor in this case... not saying we will, just if we did, then the government could retry him and get a sentence of 12 months at this point. Is that correct? No, it's he, by bringing the case to the court now, is he not saying to us, I'm willing to take the risk that my plea won't be accepted and I can't get another agreement, I'll have to contest the case and I can be confined for 12 months?
Yes,
for that be an additional six.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Can we take that into account in determining whether this individual is someone who is interested in contesting his case? You may answer the question.
I don't know if you can take that into account.
Well, counsel, could if he was retried, could he get a sentence that was any greater than what he was originally given by the first court-martial, which was 8 months?
No, but I thought the Chief Judge was talking about a trial on the new misconduct.
No, if his plea agreement is no longer in effect, what's the maximum he's exposed to?
It would be what he got at the first trial.
Counsel, what's your view on his maximum exposure? He has a sentence of 8 months. He served six.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's exposed to 2 more months confinement then?
That would be correct.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have a question on prejudice. As a result of this agreement, whatever you want to call it, the post-trial agreement, the convening authority agreed not to proceed with charges for use and possession of drugs and larceny of government property, which obviously or probably would have had a greater sentence than the 60 days additional that your client suggested to the convening authority. So in that regard, how in the world can you argue now that he is prejudiced by this agreement if in fact it looks like he got a pretty good deal?
Your Honor, he's prejudiced by this agreement by the lack of the way it was represented or memorialized in the record. This is someone who we can't infer or guess about what he knew, what he understood, what he understood. There are certain fundamental due process rights and rights for liberty, freedom. That's where the prejudice comes in. He did not have an opportunity for any type of judicial scrutiny of that animal or agreement or whatever it is we're calling it, and that's how he was prejudiced, because those provisions 13 through 16 in the pretrial agreement, those are the ones that were not explained to him. This is a 5-page PTA. The judge went over page 1, page 2, page 4, and then page 5 is the signature page. Totally disregarded that page 3. And then that page 3 is exactly what happened in this case. Those were the provisions that were called on. Those are the provisions that were where the appellant was subjected to this additional
I agree. And I think we all agree that it was error for the military judge not to delve into those provisions. But isn't there some attractiveness to the CCA's analysis? Here you have an individual who, once his misconduct was discovered, his lawyer went to the convening authority and said, listen, rather than go through and have a hearing under 1108, I'm going to make you an offer that essentially limits the amount of the suspension that you can revoke. Are we to assume that in doing that, there was no discussion as to what the meaning of the provisions were with your client?
Well, what we have is absolutely, we're going to have to assume that something happened, but what we have to assume happened, we have no idea, because there is nothing in the record that, there's very little in the record that actually says what happened, what the appellant's understanding is of the provisions, there's not even a signature by the appellant.
You're not contending that this was negotiated outside the knowledge of or over the head of the appellant, are you?
No, Your Honor, I'm not alleging that at all.
And is there anything in the record that indicates that your client would not have pled guilty had that been explained to him?
There's nothing in the record that would indicate that, but again, we can't infer that he wouldn't, because we don't know. His maximum exposure would have been 12 months. We don't know if he would have been the type of person to take that chance or what he would have thought. We have no idea what he was thinking. And there's nothing in the record that tells us what he was thinking.
Without delving into your conversations with your client, it appears from this appeal that he's willing to take that chance now. That is, he's willing to expose himself to at least 2 more months confinement. What charges were not prosecuted in this case?
Well, the two that were not prosecuted were a larceny and a 112 alpha.
And if the plea agreement's not in effect, can those charges be brought as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the maximum confinement for that?
That if it were a special court martial, that would be a year's confinement, sorry.
Why would he be limited to a special court martial on those? If there's no pretrial agreement, couldn't the convening authority now bring those charges before a general court martial?
Those two charges?
Yes. Yes, sir. So he's perhaps facing several years of confinement at this point if he wins this case.
Yes, sir. Which may go to his lack of understanding and the reason why things need to be on the record, and there needs to be judicial scrutiny for agreements such as this.
And again, counsel, without delving into your conversations with your client either, I would simply note that I hope that all these potentialities have been fully discussed with your client, that you have his affirmative agreement to them.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant submits that this court need only to look at what is clearly written in both the RCN and by the convening authority's own hand to determine the issues before it. A clear reading of RCN 705C2D and RCN 1109 state that these rules are only applicable to misconduct that was committed during periods when there was actually a judge sentence. The appellant was clearly prejudiced by the military judge's failure to go through the provisions of the PTA, dealing with the convening authority's ability to withdraw from the sentencing portion of the PTA, because the convening authority actually invoked these provisions. As a result, the findings and the sentence should be set aside.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned until next week.
The court stands adjourned until...